Welcome to ITE1 Module 12, hopefully part 1. I'm hoping we can get through everything. Today we're going to talk about advanced operating systems. Now, quite a bit of this is review, so I'm going to try and skip as much as I can of stuff that we already are familiar with as best I can. So we know that an operating system is what allows us to use our computer, and we know that from chapter 5, and if we didn't have it, we couldn't use our computer. So what are some of the operating systems that are available? Anybody?
Windows 7 Home Premium.
OS 10.
XP.
Windows XP.
Absolutely.
Linux, yeah.
Yep. And you've got all the different editions of Windows, like Jamie was talking about. You've got Home Premium, and you've got Starter, and you've got Professional, and all of those. And they talk about that too, because you're going to need to make sure that the edition that you get for your customer actually has everything they need on it. They're all kind of similar, but there's stuff that's not there that your customer might need. If you want more information on those, Wikipedia has some great information about the differences. Microsoft has also got some information. So you need to be familiar with different operating systems in case your customer isn't and they want a new system. You've got to be able to advise them on what they might need. All of these operating systems have minimum requirements for hardware, and make sure that your customer's hardware meets these requirements. Sounds pretty common sense, but it's still something you need to make sure, because people don't know and they will try to put Windows 7 on that crusty old computer that really should run XP Home at them, just about the last that's just about the last one that'll work.
I actually saw a computer the other
The
day.
best.
Just a very quick story on this. That was a Pentium 3.06 gigahertz machine with, I don't know how big the hard drive was because it had failed, and it had 512 meg of RAM, and it was running Vista very badly.
Ouch.
Ugh.
Ouch.
And this was one built by a
Yeah, a
shop.
gig at Vista. Oh dear
Good Lord.
God. Okay. So yes, that proves that these hardware requirements are important. The best place to check minimum hardware requirements for an operating system or an application is the manufacturer's website. In section 12.1.1, the first diagram, there's a test alert here because they have a table with all of these requirements for the different operating systems, and you need to study this. Amazingly, you're actually asked a question about one of the Mac minimum requirements, and that really surprised me, so I just want you guys to look out for that.
And also, can I just mention there is questions, or a question at least, on this in the final, so be aware of that.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. Now, network operating systems. Do you guys remember why those are special?
They offer services for clients, to serve clients for printers and scanners and administrating centrally and that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. And they make sure everything's all backed up and let multiple users use it and all kinds of cool things like that. And so we've got Windows Server 2000 as an example. We've also got Windows Server 2003 and 2008, and they've probably got even a newer one than that. Unix, Linux, Novell NetWare, and Mac OS X are all network operating systems.
So how do you
So if you
tell, I'm
need a review of
assuming, I mean, Mac OS X being both, how do you tell the difference between the network OS version and the personal one?
It is a network OS. OS X
It
is
does
a
both.
network operating system. By definition,
Because it's
both
got
the...
Unix under it.
No, it doesn't
Both
have
of them
Unix
are,
under
even
it.
the...
No, it does not have it has BSD under it.
BSD Darwin, that's right. I always get that mixed up.
So therefore, network
So
OSs are
there...
capable of being used as just standard personal OSs.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but it does... Yeah, you certainly can. People use, used to use Windows 2000 as, or, people can use these as a single user operating system, but you don't have to, and they give you that flexibility.
Okay.
Let's see. There are protocols that allow operating systems to perform network tasks, and we're going to do a little matching activity. So if you guys could get into chat, we're going to do see how well you know these protocols. And I need to make sure that I'm in chat before I yell at everyone else too. Okay, here we go. Let me just kill the Ventrilo window so Jaws doesn't keep flashing the taskbar, or Windows doesn't. Okay, your choices are HTTP, hypertext, they have transport protocol, but I think that should be transfer. Anyway, FTP, file transfer protocol, POP, post office protocol, DNS, domain name system, and DHCP. And so those are your choices. Now let me go back up here. The first one is, this one is how files are exchanged on the web. Which one do you think that is? It's actually HTTP, because we're just talking about how things go back and forth that are actual web pages. Okay. How about provide services for file transfer and manipulation? FTP, that's right. That's what you guys were thinking before. Yeah, that was pretty cool. Retrieves email messages from an email server. Yep, pop, pop, pop. That's right. And what about resolves URLs to IP addresses? DNS, that's right. Which one automates the assigning of IP addresses? That's correct. All right, so you guys got those. For the next section talks about directory structures that Windows creates. And there's a huge table in there, in this section, that has a list of all of them. We're going to just generally talk about some of them and what they are, but there's a fairly big list. So during installation, the Windows Setup program creates directories that have specific purposes. So you've got directories that are designed to store the operating system files. You've got for user files and program files. And, of course, we know that when files are all located in the same directory and we know where it is, we can find them more easily. Anytime we talk about the Windows folder, if you're talking about Windows 2000, that should be replaced with WinNT, because this is where 2000 puts itself. So by default, Windows XP stores most of the files created by the user in the /documents/settings/username/my-documents folder. Okay? In Vista and 7, this it's going to do the same thing, except that documents and settings is going to be replaced by users. So it's going to be /users/username/my-documents. And this folder, as we know, contains folders for music, videos, websites, and
usually
other information.
Usually that's in libraries.
That's where you keep your stuff.
Shown.
It can be, yes. There is a way to make the libraries go away, which I might be looking at because I find them irritating. The folder actually is called My Documents on the drive, but it is also available in the documents library. Many other programs
actually,
are also going to store
there's
their
a folder
stuff
and a junction point, if we really want to be correct about this. There's actually a My Documents junction point and a My Documents folder. There are both. And the junction point is for compatibility with older option for older operating systems.
What's the junction point, real quick?
That's where you link one directory to another, and you can access it by both names, but you can't actually do like regular things with a junction point. It's for programs that need to look inside of My Documents and won't look anywhere else.
All right. Yeah. That's awesome. Okay. So many other programs are going to store specific data as well. You know, you've put programs on, and they've added my extra special file type folder, you know, my Daisy books, which I really didn't need FS Reader to put on, things like that. Each account on a computer is going to have its own My Documents folder in its own user folder to keep things separate. When Windows is installed, all of the files that are used to run the computer are located in /Windows/System32 or WinNT /System32 in 2000. There's also a fonts folder where the different fonts that you use are installed. And we're not going to go over what fonts are, because we know, the chapter tells us, but if you've been playing around with Word, you know. The fonts do come in several formats, including TrueType, OpenType, Composite, and PostScript. Most of us don't really need to care, but it's in here. The fonts folder, you can access it through the control panel. And in that applet, you can go to the file menu and choose install new font, and you can put them in that way. All of the fonts on your computer are located in /Windows/fonts. Temporary files folder contains files created by the operating system and programs that are needed for a short period of time. So temporary files might be created while an application is being installed so that there's more RAM available for other applications to use. And there's different places for these. In XP, temporary files are found in /documents/settings, username /local settings /temp, And the location in Vista and 7 is going to be different, and I'm not actually sure where that is, but they do give you a table in the notes of where those are. I'm still learning
is this
7
the temp,
myself.
Is this the temp folder?
Yeah.
Echo percent temp percent from a command prompt. These are all stored in environment variables, and that's the easiest way to find it. I'll just check whether it's percent temp percent or percent user temp percent, but that's the easiest way to find them.
Yeah, and we'll talk about how to look at environment variables later.
It is percent
so
temp
you can
percent.
Consult the table. Okay. And that table is in 12.1.3 diagram 1. So there's some more locations, and this is a test alert because you're going to need to know these. There's a question on one of these. So other places that temp files can go in XP, C:\temp, C:\tmp, C:\windows\temp, C:\windows\tmp, and C:\documents\settings\user_profile%\local_settings\temp. And that user profile percent is an environment variable like Carrie was just talking about. That way the operating system can figure out who the user is without actually having to know specifically. You just set that, hey, the user is Joe, and then it looks in user profile percent and says, oh, okay, that's where this goes. And in Vista, they give C:\windows\temp and C:\users\user_profile%\appdata\local\temp, and you can find that later because you'll probably forget. Any questions so far?
That last one's what I was looking for yesterday, but I couldn't remember the path. I think I found it eventually, but yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, it takes some digging, doesn't it? The program files folder
is just as bad as the Jaws users directory nowadays.
No, nothing is that bad. Nothing is ever that bad.
You know why they did that? You know why? And people complained and whinged and moaned about the Jaws user directory, but does anybody know why it changed?
Because they wouldn't let you put stuff on the root of the drive anymore.
Settings.
No, it was actually because that is the standard required by roaming profiles. So if you are actually running roaming profiles, which is where your home directory and my documents and stuff are copied onto the workstation that you're working on, you need to store user-specific data under %appdata%. And that is why it changed. Because you don't have access to C program files JAWS on a regular machine. On a network machine. You don't have
That's
access
fair,
to program
huh?
files.
Okay, that makes sense. So,
true.
We were just talking about program files, and that's where we're going to go unless we have any more questions.
Well, the only thing I was about to say was, the only thing I would say to people is anybody who complains about the JAWS users directory, start programs, JAWS, explore my settings. Stop
yeah, they
complaining.
Do put that. They do. That didn't used to be in. I remember when that finally came in, and I was like, yes!
NVDA has the same thing, actually. There's like Explore NVDA Settings directory as well.
Oh,
they've got it as well, isn't there?
Yeah. Okay, the program file is where most programs are installed and are stored so you can run them. That's interesting. This is usually called program files on the C drive itself. In 64-bit operating systems, this is where 64-bit programs go, and the 32-bit ones are going to go in program files 86, so they've got their own folder. And as we talked about a while back, if you want to use programs over the network, you're going to have to install them on other computers. You can't just chuck that file across and have everything work. That'd be great, but no, it doesn't work that way. We're also going to talk about offline files. So offline files is a feature that's used to help mobile users be more productive. And in Windows 2000, this was introduced, and it's held over in most operating systems. Offline files and folders allows you to select shared files and folders from the network to be stored on your computer. These files are available after the computer is disconnected from the network. When you reconnect to the network, the changes that you have made offline are automatically applied to the original files on the network. If you want to know how to set all this up and view the offline files and how they work, there's a section in this chapter on it. And if you want to look at it, this is not supported in Windows 7 Starter, but it seems to be available other places. I'm not quite sure why they took that out, but, you know.
What's not supported? Sorry, I was trying to...
Offline files.
That.
Oh, Windows
because...
Windows
Starter doesn't do networking, I don't think, does it?
Yes, it does.
Just enough.
It does networking. There was actually things that said it supported .NET, didn't support .NET framework, but we found that to be incorrect as well.
Originally they were going to only allow you to run three programs at a time, and people still think that's true, and it isn't. So,
to be honest with you,
about what Starter does and doesn't allow you to do.
7 Starter is designed to run on netbooks, and you didn't pay much for the netbook to begin with, and the netbook vendor probably paid $10 or $20 for the Starter OEM license. So if you're running Windows 7 Starter on a netbook, you have two options. Well, you have three options. One is to deal with it. Second, is go borrow your mate's Windows CD and reinstall it, which I wouldn't recommend because it's illegal. And the third would be to use Windows Anytime Upgrade to pay for a better version of Windows for your netbook. But please don't go and complain to all of your friends when it runs more slowly than the Starter that you previously had installed.
I actually quite like Starter on my netbook. It works pretty well.
And you know what? Honestly, if you're going to run more than three programs at a time concurrently, like Windows being open, you're going to start really slowing down your netbook anyway. So that is almost a reasonable limitation.
Yeah, but for us, JAWS would be one of them. So we would
Yep. Word and
JAWS
web.
Would
I mean,
count as one of those programs.
And I discovered that the other day, actually. I sort of fired up one of the old Atom N270 netbooks, which isn't hyper-threading and it isn't dual-core. And once you've got JAWS open and once you've got Mozilla Thunderbird open, that's pretty much it. Don't think you're going to do too much else, because you're not. And when Quitter goes and checks for updates, things go even slower. So be patient, because these machines are not designed to be power in your pocket.
And if you ran JAWS as a service, you wouldn't have that problem, so you could have three other than JAWS, probably. If you were talking about
It's still a thread. No, it's still a thread. JFW still runs when JAWS runs as a service, as far as I can tell. I don't think they're counted differently.
Well, but we don't need to worry about that anyway, because they didn't do that. For most users in a home or small office, the default install of Windows is fine, and that would be all right. A custom installation of Windows XP is typically used in larger networks, and we talked some about this in Chapter 5, and they go over it again, and it's probably a good idea. The benefits we're going to talk about to this, they say XP in the curriculum, but you're going to experience good things in Vista and 7 well for the custom install, if that's really what you want to do. And the labs in this chapter on installing have really good information about how to do it. Now, that brings up an interesting point. These guys don't need to install an operating system unless they want to, right?
Right. You can read through that lab and answer the questions.
If you want to, Player will let you do it.
We really wanted to.
If you want to do it, Player will do an automatic install of Windows XP for you, if you have an XP.
This is the answer file. And me and another student actually have tried to get this to work, and there's an error somewhere in the instructions. We have not figured out what is wrong with the instructions that they've given us, but if anyone tries this and does figure out what's wrong, we'd love to know what it is so we can change it in the lab, because Cisco has messed up somewhere. We just don't know where.
And when that fails, we've actually been offered answer files from Chris N. No, the ones for 7. Chris N has offered us working ones.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool. So a default installation, of course, requires a little input from you. You're prompted to provide information about the specific computer and the owner or the user. Windows XP has only 2 more additional screens for a custom install. The first to customize the regional settings, and the second to customize the network settings. You can perform a custom Windows XP installation on more than one computer on a network by using an answer file that contains predefined settings and answers to the questions that are asked by the wizard. The technician can automate and customize a Windows XP installation to include the following features. We can include productivity applications such as Office, custom applications, support for multiple languages, OS deployment feature pack using Microsoft System Management Server, SMS, and we'll talk about that in a moment, and hardware device drivers if you need to. So we're going to talk about different ways that can be performed. Again, a lot of this talks about XP, but this will apply for the most part to all of them. A custom installation of Windows XP can save time and provide a consistent configuration of the operating system across computers on a large network. This is so that we can have one system that can be used on, or one setup that can be used on all computers so that we don't have to run and install from CD for every single one of them, which, depending on how many you've got, that'd get pretty ridiculous pretty quickly. So there's several different types of custom installations of Windows XP that we can do. We have an unattended installation from a network distribution point, uses an answer file, an image-based installation using sysprep and a disk imaging program, copies an image of the operating system directly to the hard drive with no user intervention. That actually sounds like it'd be pretty cool. A remote installation using Remote Installation Service, or RIS, downloads the installation across the network. This installation can be requested by the user or forced onto the computer by the administrator. And an OS deployment feature pack using Microsoft SMS dramatically simplifies deployment of an operating system across the organization. It can also dramatically decrease the wallet of said organization. This is not cheap. The unattended installation using an unattend.txt answer file is the easiest custom installation method to perform on a network. An answer file can be created using an application called setupmgr.exe located in the deploy.cab file on the Windows XP media. There's a fantastic description of a diagram that shows an answer file, so if you want to look at that, there's a really good job was done on that. After you've answered all of the questions, the unattend.txt file is copied to the distribution share folder on a server. At this point, you can do one of two things. Run the unattend.bat file on the client machine, which prepares the hard drive and automatically installs the operating system from the server over the network. Or you can create a boot disk that boots up the computer and connects to the distribution share on the server. Run the batch file to install the operating system over the network. Unattended installations in Windows Vista and I assume 7 are a little different. If you want to use the customize this installation, the System Image Manager, or SIM, is used to create the temp, the setup answer file. The Windows SIM allows you to perform the following operations. Create an unattended answer file. Update an unattended answer file. Add packages such as applications or drivers to an unattended answer file. And validate an unattended answer file, which is probably a good idea to make sure it works before you just start doing it. The Windows SIM is part of the Windows Automated Installation Kit, or AIK, and can be downloaded from the Microsoft website and, as Carrie's mentioned before, at quite a bit of bandwidth expense. Apparently it's not small.
Oops. 1.5 gig.
Ouch. When performing image-based installations, begin by completely configuring one computer
to an
operational state.
So do you have to buy the thing, or is it just live?
No, that's free. It's just big.
Oh, okay.
You do have to buy RIS, which is Remote Installation Services, but you don't have to buy Wake.
When performing image-based installations, you begin by completely configuring one computer to an operational state. Next, run sysprep to prepare the system for imaging. A third-party imaging application prepares an image of the completed computer, which can be burned onto CDs or DVDs. You could probably use Image for Windows to do that, couldn't you, or something similar?
You could, yes. That is an imaging solution, as is Drive Snapshot, which is another one.
Okay. This image can then be copied onto computers. Which one?
Drive Snapshot.
Oh, is that good?
It is good, but the restore is not as accessible as Image for Windows, in my experience.
Oh, okay. Image can then be copied onto the computers with compatible hardware access layers, or HALs, to complete the installation of multiple computers. After the image has been copied, you can boot up the computer, but you may have to configure some settings such as the computer name and domain membership. But still, that's a lot less configuration than you had to do when you installed it the first time. It's still dramatically making things easier. With RIS, the process is very much like an image-based installation, except you do not use a drive imaging utility. You can use RIS to remotely set up new Microsoft Windows computers by using an RIS network shared folder as the source of the Windows operating system files. And you can install these on remote boot-enabled client computers. And the user computers that are connected to the network can be started by using a remote boot disk or network adapter capable of booting the computer. I understand that's... Did you say that was called PXE, Carrie? Pre-execution
environment. Yes, it is.
All right, cool. I remembered stuff. The client then logs on with valid user account credentials. And this is designed to be used in a relatively small network And you don't want to be using this over low speed links of a WAN because it's not going to work very well. Finally, Microsoft SMS allows a network administrator to manage large numbers of computers on a network. SMS can be used to manage updates, provide remote control, and perform inventory management. An optional feature is operating system deployment, which requires the installation of the SMS OS deployment feature pack on the Windows 2003 server. SMS allows the installation of a large number of client computers across an entire network concurrently. Again, this is very expensive and it's not going to be as common as the other ways you can do it. Any questions?
Any comments?
All right. Any questions, comments, anything? Otherwise, we'll just keep rolling along. Okie dokie. Now we're going to talk about partitions and file systems. Some of this is review, but we'll go over it again because you'll be working with partitions in the labs that you're going to have this chapter. I'll say this now while I'm talking about it. For some of these labs, for creating the partition and the virtual memory lab, our virtual machine for XP is already set up to do these. So if you want to save yourself some headaches, go ahead and use that, and we have our presentation on how to get a virtual machine going, so you can use that. And if you haven't played with a virtual machine, it's pretty darn cool. So this gives you
a podcast to
try it. We do. That's what I was just saying. We have a CaviCast on how to do it, and it went really well. The file system determines things like the partition size, cluster size, and security features. But before we talk about that, we're going to talk about partitions. So hard disks are divided into specific areas called partitions, and partitions are formatted so that they can store information. The disk management utility displays information and performs services such as partitioning and formatting disks in Windows. There are several types of partitions on a hard drive, and this is probably review, but this confused me a long time ago. Primary partition. This is usually the first partition. A primary partition cannot be subdivided into smaller sections. There can be up to 4 partitions per hard drive. However, only one of them can be active. So an active partition is used by the operating system to boot the computer. And you've only got one of those that can be active, even though you can have up to 4 primary ones. And this is something that's going to be fairly important to remember. The next type, we have extended partition. This partition normally uses the remaining free space on a hard drive or takes the place of a primary partition. There can be only one extended partition per hard drive, but it can be subdivided into smaller sections called logical drives. In most cases, the C:\drive is the active partition and contains the boot and system files. Some users create additional partitions to organize files or to be able to dual boot the computer. Some computer makers also partition the hard drive into multiple partitions. My netbook came with a D:, where I've put my documents and downloads and stuff, just because I thought it was cool. Let me just point out, running Windows from a drive other than C, very bad idea. Some programs just do not know how to cope and cannot work properly. I know a friend who did that, and I kept telling her, this is not a good way to do things, but no.
I had a situation like that where a computer... well,
you have an interesting buzz behind you.
Still? Okay.
Yes.
That's right, we can hear you. It's just,
We can hear you. It's just odd.
I had an MP3 player plugged in, and I was installing some games for a friend of mine, and,
It does. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not that high, unfortunately.
And I don't crash it.
Yeah, I was gonna say I'm not that high, but I didn't realize that the MP3 player actually acted as the C drive. So when I after I installed Kitchen Zinc games, I came up and looked at my MP3 player. I had a C program files directory on my MP3 player, and all the
oh my goodness, that's bizarre.
Yeah, first time I saw there was no C drive, I'm like, could this even work?
So yeah, running Windows off of a drive other than C, not a fantastic idea. In all versions of Windows, disk management can be accessed either by right-clicking My Computer or the computer icon, choosing Manage, and then choosing Disk Management from that window, or using Administrative Tools, or the search. I think the search box would probably do it as well. And we had a lab in Chapter 5 that was really awesome about the administrative tools, so if you don't remember how to get there or navigate that, you can go there. In Windows, letters are used to name the drives. Therefore, a Windows computer can have up to 26 physical and logical drives. Drives A and B are normally reserved for floppy disk drives, and drive C is reserved for the primary active partition. Therefore, the maximum number of additional drives is 23 on XP and below, but it says here in the notes also that Vista and 7 can allow these A and B to be assigned to other volumes if you don't have floppy drives, which is actually kind of cool if that really does work the way that they say it does.
It does.
Would be kind of cool.
I got a question, because you're saying now on these drives you're going to have you're going to have four primary drives, one of them's going to be inactive, so, or you could have three primaries, one be inactive, and then one be an extended, and then the extended can be split up into these logical drives. But what do they call those parts? Those have to have partitions between those drives, don't they? But they don't really have a name for those partitions.
They are known
or
as
which ones?
An extended partition contains logical drives. A primary partition is a primary partition. So the extended partition contains logical drives, and the primary partition is a primary drive. Yes, you can have three primaries and extended, or four primaries. We don't go much more into it than that. Suffice it to say that an extended partition is actually a linked list of partition tables scattered across the disk, but we don't talk about that.
All right.
So, logical drive, extended partition. An extended partition must contain logical drives for the data in the extended partition to be usable. That's probably as much as I would demystify.
And if 26 drives is not enough for you, if with the Windows NTFS file system, a drive can be mapped to an empty folder on a volume and is referred to as a mounted drive. Mounted drives are assigned drive paths instead of letters and are displayed as a drive icon in Windows Explorer. I've actually never used this. It sounds kind of odd.
It works.
Use a mounted drive to configure more than 26 drives on your computer or when you need additional storage space on a volume. And if you want to make that happen, actually they talk about how to do it in here, but let's go ahead, and if you want to know how to do that, it's under disk management and they talk about it in the lab. I don't want to give too many paths because some of these you can just look up on your own if you need them.
Just a thought though, you might ask, why would I want to mount drives onto other folders? You could, for example, have a directory called /music, and then under that you could have a number of mount points, which could be 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s, all which are stored on four separate removable hard drives. And that way the MP3 collection could look as though it's on one hard drive, but in fact is scattered across how many of the hard drives you've got plugged in that you're going to try not to knock off the desk.
That's actually pretty cool, but yeah, let's hope they don't go knocking off. The disk management utility displays the status of each disk. The hard drives in the computer will display one of the following conditions, and these are probably testable, so here they are. Foreign, a dynamic disk that has been moved to a computer from another computer running Windows 2000 or XP. So that's saying, hey, I don't recognize this. Healthy, a volume that is functioning properly. Initializing, a basic disk that is being converted into a dynamic disk. Missing, a dynamic disk that is corrupt, turned off, or disconnected. Not initialized, a disk that does not contain a valid signature. That's one you don't want to see if you had a drive that used to have stuff on it, and now you're getting that. Not what you want to see, because that means something is probably very broken. Online, a basic or dynamic disk that is accessible and shows no problems. Online, parentheses, errors. I/O errors are detected on a dynamic disk. Yeah, we don't want to see that either. Offline, a dynamic disk that is corrupt or unavailable. Unreadable, a basic or dynamic disk that has experienced hardware failure, corruption, or I/O errors. Other drive status indicators might be displayed when using drives other than hard drives. You might see audio CD or no media, which are self-explanatory. Partitions are formatted with a file system. The three file systems available in Windows XP are FAT, file allocation table. You have FAT16, FAT32, and NTFS. Vista and above do not allow you to have FAT32 file systems for the main drive that Windows is on. They've said, nope, you got to use NTFS, at least for the drive. Now, you can still use FAT32, like flash drives and stuff, let's be clear on that, but the main drive cannot be formatted in NTFS and have Vista or 7 on it. They said, nope.
FAT32 and not have Vista or 7 on it. We knew what you meant, though.
That's what I meant. Oops. Okay. Thank you. NTFS has greater stability and security features. Now, what they're going to list right now, I don't think has anything to do with the file system, but it's a security thing, so we're going to talk about it. For example, Windows does not display the file extensions, but this practice can cause security problems. I think FAT32 does this too, but anyway, virus writers are able to distribute executable files by disguising a non-executable... I'm sorry, let me read that again. To distribute executable files disguised as a non-executable file. So there was a file that was, I forget, it was like iloveyou.something.vbs. That was a Visual Basic script. Then if you didn't have your file extensions and you run it, you think you'd be getting a picture or a document, and then you would have all kinds of problems. So it's a good idea to avoid this, and you should always show file extensions. And you can change that by going to the Control Panel and Folder Options. And on the View tab, there's a box that says that you would uncheck that says Hide File Extensions for Known File Types. You can also get to this under Tools in a folder window.
So they started doing there's that
also
in Windows 98.
A good argument for they did indeed. Well, I'm not sure how that's related to NTFS, but you know, whatever, go with it. There's also important things to have this on because it can be difficult for us to tell whether something is a file or a folder. We don't get
just
the cute
a point,
little
though,
icons that sighted people.
The Mac doesn't actually show extensions sometimes, so things are just
called
blah.
Yeah, it can be made to.
No.
It can be made
yeah,
to,
you
yes.
Have to, you have to turn it on.
Yeah, it's also in the Finder preferences as well. So, yeah, having file extensions on makes it easier to know what program's going to pop up when you press Enter. Saving files to the root directory of a C drive can cause organizational problems with data. It is a best practice to store data in folders created on the C drive. I think I know somebody who wasn't very good at that at one point. Anyway, you also have the lab where you're going to create partitions in XP. You're going to create a FAT32 formatted partition on a disk, convert the partition to NTFS, and identify the differences between the FAT32 and NTFS format operating systems. Again, use our virtual machine, that way you won't pull your hair out. Any questions?
The virtual machine actually has two hard disks pre-configured in it. We did this deliberately. And you will be able to
make your lives easier.
You do that lab with that virtual machine. Although I will point out that using NVDA to do that lab is always a lot of fun because you're going to have to get good with object navigation.
Ooh,
or
yeah.
Install yourself a 40-minute copy of JAWS. And anything that was written on the list about 40-minute JAWS not working on the virtual machine, don't believe it. It does work just fine. Or Windowize if you feel that way inclined.
Which virtual machine is this one? The one you had up
the
there?
XP
or is this
one.
A new one?
The XP Pro. I imagine it's probably the one that you're using.
I never noticed it had two disks in it. Wow.
I'm pretty sure it does, because it's in the VMX
Isn't
file.
One of them hidden or something?
Okay.
Yeah, one of them's got no partitions on it. You won't see a drive letter. You can't just go my computer and there's a second disk, because there's no partitions. Come on.
Because that's what you get to do. You get to make one on it.
Oh, it's just got it configured.
I'll tell you, I spent days trying to figure this out and realized that that I made didn't have one set.
Let me be clear about this. If you count hard disks by counting drive letters, I'm taking your ITE1 training wheels off you. Let's be clear on this.
Because we just talked about that. Disk management will show you all of them, whether they are ready for data or not.
Actually, the way I do it is I go into the command prompt and I run disk part, and then I go list disk. And that seems to be the most accessible way of finding out without messing with your screen reader cursors, but each to their own.
Fair enough. That works, too. All right, so there are tools that exist to help us optimize operating systems. Now, though the concepts between these are the same from one operating system to another, the paths that you use might be different. The example they give is that while virtual memory performs the same functions on a Windows 98 and Windows XP operating system, the path to find and set it is different. So you're going to be familiar with some of these tools already. Error checking allows you to check for file system errors and or fix hard drive errors such as bad sectors. And for error checking, Windows uses the program chkdsk, either via the command line or through the graphical user interface, to find and fix these problems. If you want to do it through the interface, the graphical interface, you use the My Computer or computer icon, and you locate the drive you want, access its properties, and then on the Tools tab, there's going to be a button that says Check Now, and you can hit that. And when that comes up, you can choose Scan for and Attempt Recovery of Bad Sectors. And if you do this, you're also going to check for file system problems beforehand. If you don't really care about the file error, the drive errors right now, you can run the file system one if you choose to. The check for hard disk sector errors is going to take quite some time, especially with hard drives being the sizes they are these days. But you don't actually need to check both of them. Any data that is recovered is saved to files in the root directory of the disk, and they've got funny names. The CLI version of the utility has four options to check a drive for errors, and this is testable. CHKDSK displays a status report of the drive. I'm going to say check disk from now on, and you guys can remember that that's CHKDSK, because that's easier to say. Check disk slash F fixes errors on the disk, so that's the full scan. Check disk slash R recovers readable information from bad sectors. It's funny, my Braille sense has translated that to rather, interestingly. Check disk slash X will dismount the volume if necessary. And it makes multiple, this program makes multiple passes over the disk, checking for specific criteria. And there are various phases that we go. Do you want to go through the different phases or that it uses, or just leave that? I think we'll just leave that, but it is pretty cool. So if you want to know how this program works, you can look at the notes, because it is kind of interesting, but I just want to... Well, there's so much here. Now, do we know what defragged is? I hope we know what defragged does by this point. Somebody give me a brief definition of what defragged does.
Anyone.
Anybody. What does defragged do?
It sort of reorganizes your paths, your files and stuff, and makes it more space, sort of thing.
Doesn't make more space.
Yeah, it kind of put... No, it does. You're right, it doesn't make more space, but it kind of, you're right, it does sort of put files back together, because as your computer accesses things, the files get scattered all over the drive, and it has, the disk defragmenter basically goes around and finds all of them and sort of groups them back together again. So a messy person's apartment is going to be kind of how your computer does. Eventually things get strewn all over the place, and then you can't find anything. And then when you actually decide, or have someone decide for you, that things need to be cleaned up, that's like running your defrag.
And you need to defrag Max too, unless you've got an SSD.
Yes, you do. And I'm not exactly sure how that's done, but I suppose I shall Google.
The cocktail of it.
If you want to defrag a drive, use the drive properties on the drive and choose defragment now. Do what? Okay. That
I
might be. I'd have to do a Google.
Cocktail for the Mac will do it.
Okay, fair enough. The defrag in Windows Vista and later is apparently very bad. I'm not quite sure why, but there are some other solutions. My defrag, defragler, jdefrag. These are ones Carrie and Grace have recommended. Why is it so horrible, guys? Because I honestly can't remember.
There's a problem with the task scheduler firing off and users not being aware of it and shutting the machine down in the middle of a defrag, and the Windows defrag task scheduly thing doesn't clean up after itself properly, and then for some reason the tasks can just stop running for no good reason. And it also doesn't run missed tasks that well. So that's my understanding of it.
All right. System information. Administrators can use the system information tool to collect and display information about local and remote computers. Oh, is that another reason why it's a problem? Okay. That very well could be. I have no idea.
There is actually a Microsoft utility called Boot Time Defragmenter, which will move the page file and stuff for you. Although, if you ask me, I tend to clear the page file off, do a defrag, and then recreate the page file in one fragment. But that's just me.
System Information Tool quickly finds information about software drivers, hardware configurations, and computer components. The information can be used by support personnel to diagnose and troubleshoot a computer. BellArc Advisor can give you a lot of the same information, and we like it because it shows everything in a web page and actually probably gives you more information. The free version is for non-commercial use, so if you're in a business, they would like you to pay for it. because they have a commercial version. But it is pretty cool. You can even get like your keys for various programs and stuff. The system information, though, going back to, this can be accessed through the system information option located under accessories and system tools. You can also use, I believe you can type msinfo32 on the command line in most versions of Windows to get this. I remember that from one of the labs I did a long time ago anyway. And if you need to send a file that contains all of the information about a computer to another technician or help desk, you can. And they have on the file menu in that program, you can hit export, type a name, choose where the file is going to go, and click save. This seems to take forever. Every time I've seen somebody use this or used it, it takes forever. And again, BellArt takes a while.
I just did that today, actually.
God, it takes forever, doesn't it?
Yeah, it did. It probably seemed like, I think it probably took about 5 minutes, but I didn't have I was just on a laptop here. It's not a very big laptop either. So, if you had a lot of programs and a lot more equipment on there, it probably would take a lot, real long time.
It probably doesn't actually take that long, but it's one of those things, like, it seems like it's taking forever.
Is this the BellArc Advisor
thing? No. When you save the system information.
Just
export your MS Central.
The system tool, and this tool in Windows XP allows you to get to some other tools quickly. These are Net Diagnostics. This tool runs a variety of network tests to troubleshoot network-related problems. System Restore, and this creates or loads a restore point for restoring the computer's system files and settings. No user data is backed up, so this is important, and this can be a helpful troubleshooting tool. You're going to probably be tested on how that one works. File signature verification utility. This tool checks for system files that are not digitally signed. I've never actually seen this one. DirectX diagnostics tool. This was explored in Chapter 5, and it allows you to make sure your media stuff is working properly. That was actually quite a fun lab. Dr. Watson, Dr. Watson. This tool debugs Windows to help diagnose program errors. View the information from a remote computer. You can go to the view menu and choose remote computer and give it the name that you want. We're going to talk about remote desktop protocol. This allows you to use an application such as remote desktop or remote assistance to connect to another computer. These applications allow you to view the screen and control the input computer's mouse and keyboard as though you were right in front of it. The remote desktop protocol is accessible if client and server computers have JAWS or WindowEyes on them, and it is enabled in that screen reader, and in the case of JAWS, you've paid them the lovely money they want. Cobra has remote desktop support as well, I believe. I think I remember seeing that when I was playing with the installer on the demo.
Just a little point. If you have RDP access to a computer with remote desktop, and you have audio being passed over the UDP channel as well as the TCP channel, it is quite possible to use NVDA over remote desktop with the audio coming across.
That's actually quite cool. I didn't know that was something that could be done. I didn't know that was something that could be done with NVDA. That's pretty awesome.
It can be done with any screen reader that passes the audio, but JAWS actually has this little thing that as soon as it sees remote desktop, it says, no, you haven't paid.
Yeah. Thank you.
If anybody's used the System Access, if you've ever been on System Access Mobile, you can do that through there too. You can control one computer.
Yeah, that's their own solution though.
Yeah. Brian uses it. RimRocks.
Yeah.
Yeah, apparently it's quite cool.
Yeah.
But it is separate.
It's interesting when a family member's going by your office and the speech is rattling off in the room and there's nobody there, and it's like the invisible man sitting at the desk.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I bet that would be odd. And I don't think remote assistance, which we're going to talk about next, is accessible with any of them. Basically, remote assistance allows you... The remote assistance is a feature of help and support that allows you to ask someone for help through an email invitation. And my understanding that is not accessible with any of the screen readers. Some of them have their own ways of doing that now. If you want to get to remote desktop itself, you're going to go to Start, All Programs, Accessories, and Remote Desktop Connection. Actually, sometimes it's also under Communications. And Remote Assistance uses the same protocol to allow other users to connect to your computer and help you in the same way. And they get an email that says, hey, this is what I want to do. Is it okay for me to help you and play around on this and fix it? Any questions? Virtual memory we're going to talk about next. Allows the CPU to address more memory than is installed in the computer. And this is done so that every application can address the same amount of memory. It is a swap or page file that is constantly read in and out of RAM from the hard drive. Typically, you should let Windows manage the size of the swap file unless you really know what you're up to. The only setting that they recommend you should change is the location of the swap file, and you must be a member of administrator group to make this change. And consult your notes or the labs to find out how to get to this setting. I'm not sure if this is on the test or not. You have a lab where you're going to change the location of it, and again, use the lovely virtual machine with the second hard disk. And in fact, I think they want you to do these labs one right after the other. We're going to talk about user permissions, accounts, and administrative tools. These are some of the most common administrative tools. Event Viewer, and we've used that before. The computer management, this tool allows you to access administrative areas such as system tools, storage, and services and applications. And we'll touch on this here, services. This tool allows you to manage all of the services on local and remote computers. It can also be accessed by typing services.msc in the run box. And services are, just while we're here, they are small bits of small programs that run in the background and wait for a specific thing to happen. Automatic updates is a service. The print spooler is a service. I once saw a Leapfrog toy that had its own service so that when you connected it to the computer, it could do whatever it wanted to do. These can be set to start up manually, automatically. They can be disabled, stopped, or in Windows 7, there is an option that says automatic delayed with delayed start. And sometimes if you are troubleshooting, you might need to turn off the printer spooler, for example, if you're having printing problems and you want to see if that will fix them. So that's services in a nutshell. Performance monitor. This tool displays and logs real-time information about the processors, disk, memory, and network usage of the computer. This tool is pretty inaccessible to totally blind users, and when it's mentioned in the labs, do not worry about the parts that mention the performance monitor. There is something similar called performance logs and alerts, and that we might be able to use, and I don't know if the labs actually talk about that, but that's something that should be a little bit more accessible anyway. If you have any questions on which parts of the labs you're able to do, see the accessibility document that's up. So those are the administrative tools. We've talked about services, so I'm going to go ahead. The text says that only essential services should be started. Difficult to determine what's essential and what isn't. Some of the names are not very helpful, and you have to be careful you don't kill off too many of these, because suddenly you won't be able to use something and you'll wonder, well, why can't I? Oh, I must have killed the service, and which one? So be careful when trying to smash these. A lot of people think, oh, well, that's the way I can tweak my computer. I can kill this and this and this. And then they go to send a fax and they wonder why they can't, because they turned faxing off. So it's difficult to determine which ones you should turn off, but that's how they work.
Black Viper site's pretty good for informing about services and which ones you can clip off or how to set them.
It's not a bad idea.
Yeah, I used to use...
But,
as
I say to people every year, you'll go and you'll shut down 6 services because you think your computer's going to run faster, and then you'll go to send a fax, and you'll have forgotten that 7 months ago you turned off the fax service. So keep some logs of what you did so that you can put it back if you need to. I mean, there are perfectly good reasons to shut services down if you're trying to use little netbooks or whatever to run Sing with sound or whatever and stuff. But log what you do if you're doing it on your main machine, or things that you expect to work won't. And that's the danger of shutting the services down. But yes, there are excellent sites that will tell you which ones they think you can turn on and off. But if it breaks,
Answers
you keep both pieces.
Answers.org is a good one. Tasklist.org. But again, you keep both pieces. We're pretty comfortable by now, hopefully, with the Device Manager. Don't forget that Device Manager also allows you to look at system resources, things like the DMA, direct memory access, IRQs, interrupt requests, and I/O input-output addresses. So, while we're talking about Device Manager, who wants to name one of the special icons that Device Manager uses to tell us a problem?
Yeah, yellow exclamation mark.
Okay. Jamie, what does the red X tell us? I kind of heard you first.
The process is stopped.
Can you be a little more specific with that? When a red X appears next to a device, what does that mean?
Not working?
No.
That actually means that you've disabled it. You have specifically gone in and said, no, I don't want you to work anymore. Now, the yellow exclamation point that Brad is talking about, that means that, hey, there's a problem here. And that means that something might not be working right. And there's also the question mark, which means I don't even know what this thing is.
Yeah, a lot of times you'll see things in the other category that's not had a driver installed as well. Like if you have a piece of software that's not working or you can't find it, hardware that is, then you should probably look under that category too to make sure it's not in there.
If it's there, it probably does have a question mark, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
NVDA actually reads these pretty well, at least it used to. I haven't played with it. I'll have to disable my TV tuner, which doesn't really work well anyway. Doesn't really work that well anyway, and see if it will still read me that information.
It should.
WindowWise has a script. WindowWise has a script you can put on that'll do that too. See the or an app or whatever they're calling the stupid things now. Again, we have already talked about the task manager. Control Alt Delete will get you there, or Control Shift Escape, which I think is a little harder to remember, but it's quicker. Because you don't always know what Control-Alt-Delete is going to do. And it allows you to close any applications that have stopped responding, start a new task, monitor the performance of the CPU, monitor the performance of the virtual memory, view all processes that are currently running and end them if you need to, and view information about network connections. Windows 7 also allows you, I believe, to check on services and play around with those from here. That's a bit scary because some people really shouldn't be playing with that. So I'm kind of disturbed they put it and made it a little too easy probably for some people. Here are the different tabs. The Applications tab, which is where you control programs that aren't responding, or you can start a new instance of Explorer.exe, let's say, if things have really gone bad. Processes, as I mentioned before, this shows all the processes that are running, and you can end processes or set process priorities from here. Be careful when you do either of those things. When you end a process, you may lose information in the program that the process belongs to or cause instability. And it's the same thing also when you're changing process priorities. Unless you have a very good reason for doing so, you might not want to be changing those. If you change the wrong one, you could make the system not very happy with you.
Just to explain the loss of data in end tasking, if you end task a program that saves its changes in the registry on exit, those changes will not be saved.
And if you, for some reason, were to end task Microsoft Word and you had your lovely document you were working on, it does not give Word necessarily a chance to allow you to save it, especially if you end winword.exe, then you're really, not being nice to you're really causing yourself problems. The Performance tab of the Task Manager will show you the CPU and page file usage of the computer, and this is actually pretty easy to use with your review cursor, and so some of that information that you wouldn't necessarily be able to get from Performance Monitor, you can sort of kind of get from here. Networking tab lets you see what your network card is up to and look at some network statistics. And the User tab shows all of the users that are logged on to the computer, and you can disconnect remote users or log off local users. So if someone has decided they're done with the computer and they didn't log themselves out, well, you can theoretically go in here and log them out. Or you could just, you could switch over their profile. Then again, you might not know their password. Your child has decided that it's time to walk away and they're done with everything. You can do it from there. And services, of course, in Windows 7 lets you play with those. I have to actually look at that on my netbook and see how that actually works. I mean, I do believe them that it's there, but I have to play with it. System Monitor is another part of the Performance Console, and that displays more of the real-time information on disks, memory, network uses, and stuff that we can't see. But it can be helpful for people who can see to know whether things need upgraded. If they can look at that and see, you know what, when I run, XYZ application, the memory usage is getting a lot higher, so maybe more RAM needs to go into this if this is a program that this person's going to use all the time. So it can be helpful, but it's not something that we're able to use as easily. The next thing they briefly talk about, well, I made it even briefer, is regional and language options, and that's what you're going to use to change things like your currency and the way that times and dates are written, and if you want to put in other keyboard layouts, they go here too. If
is
you
it worth mentioning
Dvorak, this is where you go.
That if you don't have your time zone and time set correctly, Twitter doesn't work, and neither do most other Twitter clients. So do keep your time zone and region up to date.
And make sure make sure it matches what Twitter thinks that you're on too. So if you're on Eastern time, tell Twitter that you're on Eastern time as well, because otherwise that can cause some problems there. And if you want to get to regional and language, you go to the control panel. Now, we talked about temporary files earlier, and the only reason we're going to come back to them is that deleting them is another way of optimizing the operating system, because oftentimes programs will leave them hanging around, or sometimes the operating system itself doesn't let you get rid of them, or doesn't get rid of them for you. They recommend looking for and deleting them every 2 months or so. That seems like a pretty reasonable amount of time to do it. This can also free up some disk space. Some of these can get quite huge. If you think about how big some of these programs are that you install, and then they spew all of their temporary stuff everywhere. And we already talked about where they are, and we talked a little bit about environment variables too. Because of the user profile percent in some of those path names. If we're going to look at the environment variables, they're used by the operating system applications and software installation programs. And if you want to see what they are, you can use the command line if you want. Not exactly sure how you can do that. But if you want to see what they're configured on XP, you can go to Start, Control Panel. Actually, you can go into the System Properties, and there's an Advanced tab in there. And on that Advanced tab, one of the choices is Environment Variables, and I believe the location will be similar on other versions of Windows. So if you're really looking for those, have a play and see if you can find them. Any questions?
Does anyone know why they call these advanced modules now?
And this is me getting rid of a lot of stuff that you've already heard about. When I first looked at this, and when I still had all the information about the troubleshooting processes, we had 40-some pages. I tried to, and we don't have nearly as much because I took all that out, and I'm skipping over some stuff. Next, we're going to talk about browsers and email applications. Because browsers and email programs are what many people are going to be using on a daily basis, optimizing them can be very helpful. i.e., Internet Explorer has settings for deleting saved files that it uses, and these files include things like your history, temporary files, which are caches of the websites that the browser makes so that if a page hasn't changed, it can go back to them, cookies, passwords, and web form information. And cookies, hopefully we're all, if anyone has any questions, but I think we're all familiar with what they do. Use the Internet Options dialog box to clear these files. And you should have an explorer of this dialog on your system on your own if you haven't played with it. Certainly, hopefully you've emptied your temporary files fairly recently. I've seen computers where that's never been done, and man, that takes a while for it to get rid of all that because it's just piled up. It can get quite... those can get quite large, and so it's a good idea to be careful with cookies. If you remove your cookies, your websites that say "Remember me when I come back" will no longer remember you anymore. So do be careful about that. Be careful if you're running things like CCleaner or other programs, because unless you're careful, that's one of the things they want to do. And it's a logical thing, but if you know you need to keep your passwords or your cookies, you'll have to tell it not to.
Just one other thing.
More information.
I was just saying, don't rely on your cookies to store your passwords. For example, your .NET passports and stuff. I know people who've lost their MSN passwords and haven't been able to get it back because they didn't set up any of the alternate contact methods, because that's all too hard. So if anybody on here owns a Gmail and hasn't put in a mobile phone number and a backup email address, please do it after lecture. Otherwise, we will just smile knowingly when you lose your Gmail password and say, "We're very sorry."
I need to actually figure out how to do that.
You sign in and it shows up and it warns you. As soon as you sign in, it goes, "You haven't set up your secondary contact preferences. If you lose your password, you're in trouble. Do you want to set them up now?" And you go, "Yeah, I will."
Yeah, I think I told it hang on, and I don't know how to get back to that again. But I'm sure it's easy enough to do. I'll look around. If you want to see, there's also more information in this section. If you really want to see how the browser uses these files, you certainly can. but we won't go over it. Now, there is a lab that says install alternate browser, and it says optional. It is not optional. Everyone must do this lab because you need the experience of installing. Hopefully you know how to install a program, but you want to get the experience of installing Firefox is what they have you use. And because of WebVism and its lovely ability to solve captchas, you should probably have Firefox if for no other reason than using, if you know you're going to use a website that has these. I don't choose to use Firefox as my main browser because JAWS Firefox support is really gross.
Yeah, you won't it will. You have to do some fixing.
Yeah, I think it can be made to work. My understanding is Firefox 5 is coming, and I don't know if that's going to be a better thing than Firefox 4 or not, but we'll see.
No, you can use 5.
There are accessibility problems with it. There are A11Y problems. NVDA has trouble with it. There are people who can't see their address bar. And it might work for you, but if it doesn't, then, well, they keep older archived versions. Avail yourself of one.
You can go to 3.6 if you want. That's the one that people
Yeah, you can do whatever you'd like to do. It just needs to be a version of Firefox for a lab that's late.
Yep, it says install browser, and it's not optional, so...
Actually, you can turn the check for updates in Firefox off. I'd recommend people
can.
Turn the checks for updates for things off where you can, except for in Skype where you can't. You need to apply a registry hack so that you don't get surprised by these updates and stuff stops working. And I'm also, I will get under a lot of fire for this, but I'm one of the people that puts on the Internet Explorer blockers to stop it from upgrading to 9 and stuff when I don't want it to.
Yeah, you got to be really careful and look at what updates Microsoft wants to put on, because it wanted to put IE9, and I said, no thank you, and I must have had to tell it not to about 2 or 3 times and say, hide this update, and it finally decided it was going to. Because then when I hit it from priority updates, it said, oh, well, we can make this an optional. No, I don't want it, period. No. So anyway.
There's actually a blocker you can get from Microsoft called the IE9 blocker, and you run it and it will never show up again until you explicitly install it.
Oh, that's really sad that they had to put it... Wow.
No, no, they've always done it. For big departments and stuff, sometimes you don't want to do a browser upgrade. So you can actually block. There are certain blockers for certain updates to stop network computers from automatically update certain critical components. Imagine if your website systems were designed for IE8, and if you jumped to any higher versions, the website would break. That's where the blocker becomes important.
I remember, and I was furious when this happened, I remember when, I think it was JAWS 8 or something, didn't work well with IE7 at the time, and the people at the library at school decided that Louis' computer should be updated to Internet Explorer 7, and I was furious, because I'm like, they have no business doing that, they are not IT people, and, it caused problems with something else. I think his Victor ReaderSoft at the time stopped working. I was furious. Anyway, enough about browsers and stuff. We're going to move on to email. Very briefly, when we set up an email account, email client, we need to put the following kinds of information into it. You need your display name, your email address, the type of incoming mail server that you're using, POP3 or IMAP, your incoming mail server name, the outgoing mail server name, and the username and account password for those. And if you're doing really goofy things, you might need different port numbers as well. That's where your ISP or your network administrator should be able to help you. We have a matching activity for email protocols. Would you guys like to do this?
I think we're
going to do this, and we're going to make sure everyone's awake. Okay. Now, I'm not going to actually give you the choices because I want to see which ones you... there's one of these you probably won't know, but I want to see what ones you know without having the choices beforehand. This protocol retrieves emails from a remote server over TCP/IP. Yeah, this one is actually POP because it says it does not leave a copy of the email on the server unless you specify. So, sorry, I didn't read far enough.
I kind of wondered that myself. I was like...
I'm sorry. Fail on my part.
I think they all do that.
Well, yeah, you're right. They both let you get your email. This protocol allows local email clients to retrieve email from a server, and it typically leaves copies of the emails on there for you. So which one is that now? Yep, IMAP, Internet Message Access Protocol. There we go. It's also great if you've got multiple devices and clients. This
I think
protocol
we should have a discussion on IMAP. I really like it.
There's not a whole lot to discuss about it. We could talk about it on the... You know, a social one when there's nothing going on sometime. Do we have anything tomorrow, by the way? Because we don't have anything scheduled.
Well, sometimes a lot of people I noticed have some trouble, I know, when configuring different clients, because different clients handle the deleting of emails differently and you know, things like that.
Oh, fair enough, Gmail. Yeah. Yeah, well, I suppose at some point we might talk about that. Anyway, this protocol transmits emails across a TCP/IP network, and it is the email format for text only, and it uses ASCII. So which one is that? That's correct. Now, this one you might not be as familiar with. This protocol extends the email format to include text in ASCII standard as well as other formats such as pictures and word processor documents, and it's used in conjunction with TCP. Anybody know what that one is? Absolutely. And it stands for Multi-Purpose Internet Mail Extension, or MIME. All right, good job. Okay, now we're going to talk about some of the options you may need to configure after you've installed the operating system for the customer. I'm sorry, this chapter is really badly organized. You may need to set things such as the screen resolution, and we know about that, what that is. Be careful when you're working about that you're paying attention to what the native mode of the resolution is, or the display is, and that's going to be done in the control panel. If this is set incorrectly, you could possibly have a Windows desktop that does not take up the full area of the screen, or a blank screen if the resolution is set too high. And you can use, we'll talk a little bit more about low resolution video and how you can use that to fix it, or VGA mode. Refresh rate is something else that you can change. The setting determines how often the image on the screen is redrawn, and it's expressed in hertz. The higher the refresh rate, the more steady the screen image is going to appear. Some people are very sensitive to this, so even though you might not care because you can't see it, knowing how to choose that and how to change it could be really important for your customer. So you should probably explore how that's done. And I think that one of the labs that we've done looked at where that setting is. And the display colors and the color depths can also be changed if you need brighter colors. And the display applet in the control panel is used for all of these. And if you want to know how to do them in your operating system, you should go ahead and play with them for yourself, or do a Google or something. They go on to talk about updating the video driver, and the procedure for that is fairly standard to updating other drivers. So I won't go over that. If you need to go over that in the notes, you can. Basically, you're going to get the driver from the manufacturer's website, the most up-to-date driver, and install it according to their directions, reboot the computer, and pray that it works. And here are some things that you can do if the driver doesn't work correctly. So problems that can occur after you update this, the video adapter driver, you are unable to view the screen when you restart the computer. If this happens, reboot and press and hold the F8 key until the startup options menu appears. In XP, choose Enable VGA mode, or in Vista, it's called Enable Low Resolution Video. Then, roll back the driver in the device properties for the video card in Device Manager. Multiple OSs can be run on a single machine, though not usually at the same time unless you go playing with virtual machines that we've talked about. In this instance, we're talking about dual booting, so pick one when you boot up and that's the one you get until you reboot. Maybe you want to use Linux and Windows on the same machine, let's say you're wanting to see how this works. That's one reason you might have a dual boot situation. There's a dual boot process for multiple operating systems on a computer that we're going to talk about. Going back to some of the boot files we looked at, when the boot.ini file determines that more than one operating system is present during the boot process, you are prompted to choose the operating system that you want to load. The diagram shows a sample boot.ini file, and you can have a look at that. To create a dual boot system in Microsoft Windows, you typically must have more than one hard drive, or the hard drive must contain more than one partition. So that's why we talked about that earlier, because you may need to use more than one if you're going to do what we're talking about right now. You should install the oldest operating system on the primary partition or hard drive marked as the active partition first. Now, I don't necessarily mean, I mean the one that you plan to use first, and then the newer one, the one that you want to use after you've got the first one set up, is what you'd install next.
Lifehacker has good guides on this. They do it when they're talking about putting 7 and XP and 7 and Vista and XP and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so you could probably get information. And the boot files are automatically installed in the active partition. And during installation, the boot.ini file is created on the active partition to allow the selection of the operating system to boot from startup. The boot.ini file can be edited to change the order of the operating systems, and you can also edit the file for the length of time an operating system selection can be made during the boot phase. Typically, the default is 30 seconds, and this always delays the boot process by the time you put in here. The text is saying that 5 to 10 is a good idea, and for a sighted person, that's probably true. For us, we need to find a time that's a good compromise between the two so that we know the menus come up and give us time to choose, but also doesn't take too long. So that's something that we have to work with. To edit boot.ini in Windows XP, you're going to go to the System Properties. You can either go right-click My Computer and choose Properties or go through the Control Panel. In the Startup, and there's an Advanced tab, and on that tab there's a Startup and Recovery area. You're going to select Settings, and then there's an Edit button to edit boot.ini. To edit this in Windows Vista, use the bcdedit.exe command line tool from an elevated or administrator command prompt. And it tells you how to make sure that your command prompt is an administrator. Basically, you find the icon for it and choose Run as Administrator, or I think you can hit Alt-Enter from the search box to run something as an administrator, but I'm not quite sure. So you can figure out how to make your command prompt as an administrator. When troubleshooting problems with the operating system, you may need to use CLI commands and options to perform tasks. This may be necessary if Windows will not start, or from within Windows at a command line, you can use these. The notes talk about using CLI commands and tools to troubleshoot. Like we said, first is the first one they talk about is msconfig, and we've talked about what it does before, and they provide a procedure to use with it for startup problems. They basically say that if you're really having problems, you go to selective startup, uncheck them all, and then restart checking one item at a time until you find the one that breaks, and then go back and uncheck it and play around with those. And the text describes how you do that. And if you look at the common problems and solutions at the end of this chapter, which you all should be doing for every chapter because these are testable, and I've found that out the hard way, there are questions in there that the module may not cover very adequately. System config will almost assuredly be in there. So have a look at the very last section, identify common problems and solutions.
System may I recommend the virtual SFC machines for all of this?
Yes. Absolutely, you can break.
If you haven't got your virtual machine yet, why don't you log into our website and supply the username and password provided by your instructors to get your virtual machine up and running?
Okay. SFC is something we've already talked about too. The idea is to replace the files from that are maybe corrupt from the installation media. And if you've performed a service pack, just don't, because it can make things go very badly. See Chapter 5 for more information on this. The command line is sfc /scan now if you choose to use it. And there's a diagram that lists quite a number of commands for the command line, and many of them aren't talked about here. So if you'd like more, read that. Any questions? Okay, upgrading operating systems. And we've talked a little bit about this. It is important because they need upgrades just like everything else does, because technology changes, new hardware comes out, and XP might not support it anymore, or you know, you get a new computer and it doesn't have XP anymore, and you might have to eventually just learn to deal. But in this case, we're talking about older computers that need Windows upgraded. A Windows XP upgrade can be performed from a CD or over a network. You should ensure that the new operating system is compatible with the computer, and Microsoft provides a utility called the Upgrade Advisor to scan the system for incompatibility issues before upgrading to newer Windows operating systems, and it's actually pretty cool. You can download the Upgrade Advisor from Microsoft Windows website for free. When you're upgrading, just like we talked about before, make sure that the operating system you're upgrading to, make sure your computer meets the requirements for it, or hopefully exceeds them by some margin. Some computers, just there's no point in upgrading them because they won't run anything that's much newer than what's already on them. Others, you can do it and you'll be just fine. But you need to make that determination the same way you do when you're selecting one from a customer. Make sure it will work. Make sure the hardware will do it. Not all older Windows operating systems are upgradable to the newer versions, as described in the following list here.
And Windows, you guys need to know that.
Yeah, you do need to know this. Windows 98 SE and Windows ME can be upgraded to Windows XP Home or Windows X. It says or Windows XP Professional. That seems kind of broken to me. Maybe
no, it's true.
Okay.
Yes, they can.
Okay, fair enough. Windows NT Workstation 4.0 with Service Pack 6 and Windows 2000 Professional can be upgraded only to Windows XP Professional. That's what I was thinking of. Funnily enough, Windows 3.1 and Windows 95 cannot be upgraded to Windows XP. I wonder why. The Windows 2000 or earlier cannot be upgraded to Windows Vista. And finally, only Windows Vista can be upgraded to Windows 7. You cannot go from XP to 7. You must install Vista first or just go straight to 7 and do a reinstall. So you can only go from Vista to 7, which has made quite a few people rather angry. But hey, that's just the way they did it. Remember to back up all data prior to beginning the upgrade. It's supposed to leave your stuff alone, but it's a good idea to back up before anything major like this. And that way, if there are problems, then you'll have all of your information still available to you. Finally, we are going to talk about preventive maintenance briefly. Operating systems need this to make sure that your operating system stays up to date. And these tasks include scheduling automated tasks, applying updates such as service packs and security patches, and updating or fixing corrupted drivers. Something else that are useful for maintenance before you perform some of these updates, restore points are useful here, especially before before you do some of these. You can crash things. If things crash, then you can go back. If your video driver crashes, that might be one way to fix it. Sometimes things just go wrong and you don't really know why, and restore can be helpful. Basically, the point here is they want you to do things like using Windows Update, getting rid of the temporary files like we talked about, possibly scheduling defrag and stuff. You have a lab on how to schedule tasks, and you can do that with the task scheduler through the command line interface or through the AT command on
they
the
get
command
to do
line.
It.
That's actually kind of a neat... Yeah, and you get to do it, but that was kind of cool. The AT was kind of neat. I liked that. So you can that's when you schedule a program to run at a particular time, and the task will run when the time is reached. And, so you can schedule things like defrag, check disk, backups, and other maintenance tasks, are the kind of things that you might schedule. I had a friend that had a program called alert.exe that he wrote, and basically anything you gave it as a command line argument would pop up in message box with that text. He used to use it to remind himself of when various TV shows came on, because apparently that was that important. You should use one of the following methods to configure updates for the Windows XP operating system. And the other ones have similar settings, but the wording of XP is particularly important. You need to know these if you don't already. Automatic, you need to specify a day and time. Download updates for me, but let me choose when to install them. Notify me, but don't automatically download or install them. Or turn off automatic updates, which is not recommended, it says next to it. These settings can be found under automatic updates in the control panel. That is the end of the actual notes, and I cannot believe I actually got through that as quickly as I did. We still have a quiz, and we still have some troubleshooting activity things to do. So, we're going to do those first. And I've already got them pulled up, and hopefully they haven't gone anywhere. Figure out which one I was going to do. Let's go look at the one that says...
Okay, we're doing a thing on tomorrow on the 12.4.5 worksheet, just so you know.
Which one was that again? The
12.4.5.
That doesn't tell him anything. Okay. That's like saying 20.8.
Yeah,
minus
I can't
6.2.
Remember.
2.2.
That is the gigantic five-part lab where you do all sorts of different things.
Ooh, fun! Yes, that one. Okay, see, that should have... Okay, that helps. Okay, so this is 12.5.3. This is the one that says troubleshoot operating systems. Okay, so I'm going to give you some problems, and we're going to look at what might be the cause of these. And let me see where they're at. Okay, so if a program doesn't start automatically, what can we do to make that happen? Why might that not be happening?
What do you mean doesn't start automatically?
If a program that's supposed to start automatically isn't, then why might that not be working right?
Which program?
You could check under startup. Yeah, I was gonna say.
It doesn't actually say. They're actually saying they want Performance Monitor to start automatically, but it could be any program. It doesn't really matter. But if it's supposed to be starting automatically and it isn't, what would be a way that we can? Why might that be? I'm not very good at these ones because I've not really done one of these before.
It's not initiated in the MS config under the startup. Is that what you're getting at when it's starting up the computer?
Yeah, it's not actually set to. So how can we make that happen?
Well, some programs will allow you to do that in their settings, and it will set it. Otherwise, you could go into msconfig and set it there, right?
Well, but you can't go into msconfig and set it if it's not there to begin with, if it's a new program that you're trying to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never heard of being able to go into msconfig and tell it to start something. But you could go under startup under programs and put it there.
Absolutely. That's absolutely what you could do.
Pity it's hard to do that under 7.
Yeah, it is a real pain in the...
And there is a startup tab. Yeah, he's right. There is a startup tab in msconfig. There certainly is, and you can do it in there.
Well, you can turn them. I don't think you can add a new item, though.
Yeah.
Yes, you can. No, you can't. If it's in there already, though. No, if it's in there already, you're...
Yeah.
You can either check the program's preferences or try to add it to the startup group in the program's folder in start menu.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, msconfig, when you actually look at that, that's everything that starts from the registry, if I'm not entirely mistaken. So unless you feel like actually hacking the registry and doing it that way, that's about the only way I know of to actually get something into the startup for msconfig.
That's not as bad as it sounds, but not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, it's not. Okay, for this next one, you've got a computer, and the icons on this computer are rather large, and things don't quite look right. What could be the problem here, and how could we fix it?
So your screen raise is too high, perhaps.
Well, it wouldn't be. It would probably. You're right. It is the screen resolution. But if things are too big, would it be too high or too low? Which would it be?
I don't know. I guess either way, it's wrong. So I guess I'd try setting it back to the native thing.
Well, yeah, you do want to set it back to the native resolution. But if things are too big, which way is it adjusted incorrectly?
It's too high.
It's too high.
Correct.
No, that's wrong.
No, it's too
low.
So as things
get
smaller numbers,
the way you can think of it,
smaller,
the closer things are, the bigger they are. The further you're away you are, the smaller they are. So the bigger the res, the smaller the things are going to be. The more dots per inch you've got, the smaller things are going to be.
It's hard to remember when you're blind.
Zooming in on the things.
That's another... resolution is not necessarily zooming in, but it's adding more and more greater detail to what you have. It's like sample rate. If you have a file and it's an 8,000 hertz file, it's going to sound awful. But then if you resample that, well, it would still sound kind of bad because of that, but 44,100 is a lot better because there's more information to work with. The sample rate's higher. So more detail is more resolution. So how would you, knowing that that resolution is too low and it looks pretty gross, how do we fix it?
You go into your display settings. Your control panel.
Yep, that's right. You go...
Display properties.
Yep, you're going to go into... Yep, that's right. You're going to fix it there. Now, I've noticed something, too. Good job on that one. There was another problem that was too evil that I just won't give to you because it's awful. So good job on those. I've noticing that more graphics cards are actually telling you now, hey, this resolution is not what your monitor wants. This is not native resolution. To change it, click here. I've seen two computers recently do that. My netbook does that, and I've seen one at work do that.
There's another gotcha, actually. Sorry, go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, as I said, just out of curiosity, because I haven't actually looked at these labs, I was curious as to know what that other problem is that's so bad.
Yeah.
They have the computer will not boot, and what you were to do if you were the instructor, what you were to do to your students is actually delete ntldr.exe from the hard drive and see if they could figure it out.
I knew someone that wrote a website that automatically did that to a machine once. And
oh my god, that's awful!
So yeah, that's something I would have actually thought of, because... Yeah, what had happened is, and he tested that, like, he didn't release the website or whatever, he basically did it because he was bored, and he was this super coding genius, and he felt like it. So he wrote this website and built a machine, it was Windows XP at the time, built a machine, patched it all up, antivirus, anti-spyware, everything, you know, made it this absolutely secure as machine, put this machine on the website, and of course the machine worked fine, turn off the machine, and it won't come back up again.
Wow, that's pretty amazing, actually. Like, amazingly awful, but that's pretty...
Scared the heck out of me.
I had my own boot up problem. My computer, after I've just moved into the townhouse about a week ago, and my computer started, whenever I turned it on, it would, about five out of six times, I'd turn it on, and it would say, no operating system found, and it would do a double beep at me after reading the floppy drive and a whole bunch of other things. So, finally, the two out of 12 times, the second time that it actually worked, because it beeped the first time, I plugged in more things thinking there was a problem because you had to have a monitor plugged in or the keyboard wasn't plugged in properly or something, so I turned it on the second time it worked. Then I actually plugged in my headphones and monitor and Ethernet cable, turned it on, it didn't work. So finally, the second time that it did work, I ran check disk, tried to make it restart, crossed my fingers, crossed my toes, prayed to all the saints. It check disk actually ran, and I guess it fixed a little hiccup on the drive or something. I guess one of the platters got damaged or something. I don't know, but it works now. And after I
pushed it, wouldn't fix the entire platters getting damaged, but
weird.
You tend to have very unusual computer problems.
Yeah, you're kind of like me.
I know. I'm getting really sick and tired of them.
Okay, we have another activity to do. Here is your scenario. The computer will not connect to the internet, network shares, or network printers. What are some solutions we could use to figure out why this might be?
A bad NIC card.
How do we check for that? That might be the problem, but how do we rule? How do we make sure?
What am I thinking of? Device manager and
first
see if
check
the card's
cables.
Working.
Check
yep, checking the cables. Well, actually, this is wireless, though. This is actually wireless we're talking about. I broke that.
Oh, wireless, okay.
We're talking about wireless internet. But if we were talking about cabled internet, you would want to check those.
Check, make sure
check.
SSID is right.
Well, you still need to check the wires, though, going to the wireless.
And you can't...
No,
you can't actually... You can't actually see any networks right now. The networks are not showing up. You can't see
them.
Can
you ping your router?
That would be one solution. You could use command line tools to try and ping and see what's going on. However, you've done that, and it still hasn't worked.
What about IP config?
Yeah.
See if it gives
you
your auto IP configuration.
Nope, that doesn't work either. So you've tried your command line tools, and they're not working either. What else can we try?
What? Check the actual...
Look in device manager.
Yes, we could look in device manager. And, okay, so we've looked at device manager.
This looks like this little kid that was trying to plot me into a hole. It's like you're walking along the road and there's a big hole.
Yeah. It's really hard to find a way to do these. So we see that the card is here.
What's in the device manager when you look, Sean?
There's something wrong with it. There's a little question mark or an exclamation mark. So something is wrong here. What might that be?
Driver problem.
Absolutely. You have a driver problem. So
or check this.
Okay, Jamie, you could update the driver. What was yours?
Update the driver.
Yep, either of those would work. Now, what they actually did was they said, okay, student that we're working with, we're going to go and we're going to delete your driver so that you don't even have one. And now you have to figure out what it is. So the solution that they actually recommend, and it's okay that you didn't get the same one because I don't really like their solution, they're saying they want you to use System Restore to fix that. But you could just put the new driver on and you'd still have it fixed.
Except you'd have to know exactly what type of card you had, though, for it to work.
And the other thing
that's
I was wondering
true, you
is,
would.
System Restore, if you delete a file, which your drivers technically are, but if you delete a file, you can't get it back that way.
Yes, you can.
Where are those driver
yes,
files
can,
located?
Yeah.
Think about it.
Yeah, where are the
where
driver
are
files
located?
The system restore takes shadow copies of the driver files because they're in C Windows C System 32. So even if you smash all the files out of there, you can actually restore the files back from the restore points in those particular locations. Doesn't work for data files.
No, you're right.
Does work for operating system files.
Yeah, because they're files that are that are part of the operating system. So that's why system restore would work.
That's why data doesn't get changed, for instance, your files and your emails and things like that.
Yep, doing system restore is not going to help you get that thesis back that you accidentally deleted. Or this
previous versions will.
Yes, that is true. Under 7, I haven't actually played with that. I'm not actually sure how that works.
It's really easy.
Time playing.
And newer operating systems?
Yeah, Windows 7.
Just don't use shift-delete for import for files.
No, it works with shift-delete.
At least I just meant as a strategy. Then at least you can go, oops, I wrong one.
Under Windows 7, there's a thing called previous versions. Basically, it keeps copies of your document files and stuff in the shadow copies of the restore points as it takes them, and it is possible to recover files from previous versions, and you just go, view previous versions of files, and it says, these are the previous versions you've got, which version do you want? And then it'll pull back various versions of the file. There is no guarantee that previous versions did take a snapshot, though, which is why you've got a backup, right? Right.
Absolutely.
Also, Microsoft Word itself, I don't know about anything else, but Microsoft Word can do some very... can be surprisingly good at recovering different things. Firstly, there's the file recovery task pane, which is interesting to navigate around, but it can certainly be done. I've done it, I just can't remember how. And there's something else as well that I did once when... it wasn't even in there because my Word had thrown a major spaz. Again, I can't remember how to do that. I'll have to refresh my memory, but it was brilliant. It got back most of a uni essay that had died. It was very, very cool.
And you got very, very lucky. We have a quiz, and we have a few minutes. Do you think we have time to it, or should we save it for the beginning of next week?
Let's get it
done.
Let's see if
we can get it done here. We might run a little bit over, but let's go into chat. Let me close out these activities. You did a great job on those. So, Grace, have you taken a poll of who else in here?
Yep, I have.
Okay, can you send me that so I can mark them in, or if you want to mark them in, whichever way
you
want to do it.
For you.
Thank you so much. That's great. God, I ended up with so many windows open. Okay, there we go. Okay.
So don't do this on the netbook, Sean.
Yeah.
I'm definitely not on the netbook. I'm on a computer that's slower than the netbook, but it's more stable. Okay. Number one. How many active partitions can a hard drive have? A, 1, B, 2, C, 4, or D, 8? Answer now. That is correct. Number one. Or A is the right answer. You can only have one. Number two, which system tool consolidates files to enable faster access? Hang on, is that from the older one? I was like, wait, I haven't even given answers for this one yet. Okay, is it A, file attributes, B, computer management, C, defragmentation, or D, disk format? Choose now.
Must be D.
And the answer, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Disk format will make your system run faster.
Oh, yeah, it'll do
we've got a bloatware, too.
No, the answer is C, for real, is defrag. Number three, a new graphics card is installed in a computer. When the computer is powered on, the default drivers are loaded, but some of the applications do not work properly. What should the user do to improve the graphics card performance? We'll see what the answers to this one are. A. Check the Microsoft website to find the latest driver. B. Check the website of the manufacturer for the latest drivers. C. Configure the application to run correctly with the new graphics card. D. Configure the graphics card to graphics card settings correctly in the start menu. Choose now.
Those crappy Microsoft drivers.
Yeah, they want you to get the manufacturer's driver, so B is the correct answer. Number four, which is the default Windows update setting? A, automatically download recommended updates for my computer and install them. B, download updates for me, but let me choose when to install them. C, notify me, but don't automatically download or install them. Or D, turn off automatic updates. Choose now. Absolutely, it is A. It want... Okay. It is A. You want to I'm
trying to type on my phone
work.
And type at the same time. That doesn't work.
Well, okay, let's not multitask.
That's brilliant.
Too much then. You don't seem to be doing too great.
No.
Okay, so it is automatically installed because they want to make sure that you're up to date. 5. Which Windows XP function allows the system to roll back to a previous state? Is it A, automatic update, B, NT backup, C, restore point, or D, scan reg? Choose now. Yes, it is C. The word what they really meant, of course, was system restore, but a restore
system
point
restore,
is what it
creates,
so it doesn't really matter. Same idea, though, as long as you remember that.
Couldn't NT backup also have been an option? Because that is a backup and restore
thing.
You have to have actually made
a backup of the system state, though. And I did the lab, and I couldn't get that to work properly. Theoretically, that could work. But restore is what most people are going to use. 6. Which two file systems can be used by Windows XP? This is choose 2. A, DOS. Yes or no? Very good, that's no. If any of you had answered yes, I'd be taking your ITE1 license away. B, EXT3, yes or no? I think Carrie has dreams about that one actually working in Windows. But no, it doesn't. How about C, FAT32?
No, I don't. EXT2's a pile.
EXT3, it said.
Well, it's still a pile. It doesn't scale well to large numbers of files and folders, so no, I don't dream about that. BTRFS, yes.
Oh.
Join the dream.
Well, I remember one time I got this question and you said, oh, I wish, so that's what I was going off of.
Go ahead.
How about D, HPFS? You're right, no, that is not a choice. And how about E, NTFS? That is correct. And the other choice, Vista, is not a file system. So, moving on.
It's not number even 7. An operating system, I'm just teasing.
Well, according to
yeah.
it isn't, you know. For the majority of people, that seems to have been the case. I am so sorry. Number 7. While performing maintenance on a computer, a technician finds a program listed in the registry that is unavailable on the Start All Programs menu. What is the probable cause of this problem? Is it A, the program failed to uninstall properly? B, the program has been disabled in the BIOS? C, the program is incompatible with the operating system? Or D, a recently installed device driver is incompatible with this program? Choose now.
Or it's a virus.
I thought for a second you were going to say a technician found a snake in the power supply.
No. Come on.
Especially with maintenance.
No. It is A. The program has not properly been uninstalled. Number 8. In which folder are most applications found in Windows Vista? A, the Windows folder. B, the Applications folder. C, the Program Files folder. D, the Windows System 32 subfolder. Choose now. That's correct. It goes in Program Files, so C is correct. Number 9. What is the purpose of a system management server in a Windows Vista environment? A. It can be used to deploy updated hardware abstraction layers or HALs software. B. It is used to install wireless client operating systems across a wireless network. C. It can be used to hold the various unattend.txt files used for corporate image deployment. Or D. It can be used to manage updates, deploy an operating system, or perform inventory management. Choose now. No, the actual answer they want is D. It allows them to manage updates, deploy an operating system, or perform Think about it. Which one's the one they gave us the most information on? It's that one right there. The other ones they were kind of sketchier on, I think. Number 10. What Windows utility is used to create a partition on a second newly installed hard drive? A. Task Scheduler. B. Device Manager. C. Partition Manager. D. Disk Management. Choose now. Yep, it's Disk Management. 11. What is virtual memory? Is it A, RAM that does not have to be refreshed? B, a swap file on the hard drive? C, memory that is located inside the processor and inside the processor's housing? Or D, extra memory on the motherboard that is accessed when the video RAM is exhausted? Choose now.
Gotta love that one.
Yeah. Yeah, the answer is B, it's a swap file. They get some really creative answers in here. 12. What is the probable cause of a Windows Vista computer running slowly and having delayed response to user input? Besides
you turned
it being
it on.
Windows Vista. Besides it being Windows Vista. Okay. In all seriousness, A, a process is using most of the CPU resources. B, index services settings in the advanced options panel are incorrect. C, UAC has not been enabled in the user account applet in the control panel. Or D, the computer does not meet the minimum hardware requirements for running Arrow. Choose now.
All of the above.
A is correct. They're saying that the that
although
could
D could
they're
do it
saying
too,
that it's
not?
The that's my no, thought. I would say A. I no, would say possibly D because Windows Vista does have Arrow, and I would say that could slow things down.
Okay. A is not Arrow is not enabled on low spec computers though. That's their point when it does
the computer
benchmark.
Oh, is that why that
benchmark.
Doesn't work? Oh,
yeah.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Okay. Well, at first I wasn't quite sure, but the answer they had marked there was that there's a process that's taking up a lot of resources. 13. After troubleshooting a computer, a technician presses F8 during the boot process and selects Disable Automatic Restart on System Failure from the Advanced Options menu. This one they didn't really talk about except maybe in that solution section, but we'll keep going. Which problem is the technician trying to solve? Is it A, the computer displays a BSOD? B, the computer locked up without any error messages? C, a device or service failed to start when the computer booted? Or D, the computer was continually restarting without displaying the desktop? Choose now. The correct answer is D, the computer was continually restarting. Basically, that's a setting that it restarts instead of actually showing you the blue screen so you can see what the problem is. So, disabling this option, and you can do it through Windows as well, in the advanced options, is a pretty good idea. Okay, 14. Which CLI command is the best command to copy the contents of one hard drive to another? Again, this is in that diagram, but we'll see what we come up with, what you guys like. A, copy. B, ncopy. C, xcopy. Or D, zcopy. Choose now. The answer we want is actually C, xcopy, because that also makes sure that subfolders get copied as well, subdirectories. And that is the quiz. So thanks so much for coming today, guys. Sorry we ran over a little bit, but I wanted to get this quiz out of the way. And it's been fun.